You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 313 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Illness and Therapy, Spiritual Scientific Aspects of Healing, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on the 17th of April, 1921. I will turn now to pharmacology, which we will discuss also in relation to medicines we have already tried to develop. Let me note specifically that I have no interest in giving an account of my train of thought in arriving at a potential medicine. My concern instead is for you to understand how a certain substance can be used medicinally. The insight we need into a substance is one I would like to see unfolding in each physician's soul, giving it value as a medicine. Today, therefore, I would like to use our discussions to probe into ways in which we might come to see that a particular substance could be a medicine. A foundation for this, as I must of course first mention, is familiarity with the major principles of anthroposophical insight into the human being. A proper interpretation of a medicine can only arise if we are, as it were, energized from below to shed an anthroposophical light upon our whole inquiry. You will also see, therefore, that what I have said in preceding days will flow into our deliberations today. Let us assume that the plant, in particular, allows us to study the reciprocal action between our surroundings and ourselves as human beings. By first versing ourselves in processes at work in the plant, we can gain the right view of how mineralization processes work their way through into our interior. If we embark on this kind of inquiry, and this is, of course, based on everything we have considered in the past few days, we must be clear that in the whole plant development process, the process whereby roots, leaves, blossoms, seeds, and so forth are shaped, lies something configured out of the whole cosmos. We must also realize that this process, especially as it takes shape in plant forms, including their inner forms, cannot be replaced by some kind of merely artificial synthesis, in other words, by chemical compounds. Only in the very rarest cases can this natural synthesis be replaced by an artificial one. We have to be clear about the following, for instance. Within plant development processes, the root of a plant is more or less bound up with the inner forces of the earth's surface. Now, human beings are plant-like in the sense that their soul and spirit grow from above downward. Our head contains many of the same forces that interact with the forces of the earth itself. And there is a profound affinity between what forms as root in the plant and all the forces at work in the human head. Whenever we seek to understand the process at work in the root parts of a plant, therefore, we will need to see that this process has a reciprocal relationship with the human head. But let us now embark on our inquiries by starting with specific details, so that you can see how such inquiries should be conducted. Let us, for instance, consider the gentian root, Gentiana lutea, and pursue the following train of thought. The gentian is a plant which expresses itself outwardly in strong flowers. In the root, therefore, we will have forces that are drawn strongly toward the floral aspect. In other words, these root forces are somewhat weak. The gentian plant expends itself a great deal in flowers and leaves. Nevertheless, The whole form of the flower shows that the plant's root aspect is still strongly present. Therefore, we cannot necessarily count on the gentian having a strong effect on what proceeds directly from the human head organization and is intrinsic to it, that is, as external physical effect. But instead, we can expect it to work primarily on the respiration-promoting activity emanating from the head. And since we always find a polar action in the organism, we must imagine that the digestive organs themselves can be induced to breathe more strongly, in the sense described yesterday, if we use the gentian's roots. In other words, we stimulate the stomach and intestines to respire more actively, and must then consider what we have learned during these lectures, that to stimulate this respiratory activity, plant substance must be processed, in this case, by making a decoction of the roots. We must use a root decoction. You see, we can really penetrate all this with understanding. Here we first look at external aspects, discovering that the gentian root has a bitter taste and a strong smell, and so this is something that works very strongly on the astral. We therefore have here an action exerted on the astral nature of our digestive parts. But the gentian root also contains sugar. I have repeatedly pointed out, as you will recall, that when we assimilate sugar in the human organism, this process greatly stimulates eye activity. You can even confirm this statistically, as I have said, by studying how nations with little eye activity, such as those in Eastern Europe, the Russian peoples, in whom the eye is less predominant, have very low national annual sugar consumption, whereas the English, in whom the eye develops extremely brisk activity, and this is true in general the further west we go, have a proportionately higher sugar intake, as statistics demonstrate. Such things must certainly be taken into account if we wish to develop understanding of the world. A further characteristic of the gentian root is that it is rich in fatty oils. Fatty oil works strongly on the lower respiration when it passes into the digestion, since it strengthens motility, the inner mobility of stomach and intestines. You can see, therefore, how one can describe in detail what occurs here within the human organism. Immediately, one notices that astral activity is stimulated, thus stimulating respiratory mobility of the stomach and intestine. And then one sees that the intestines develop a brisker activity and that the stomach is strengthened. The whole thing takes effect to create a condition that always arises when the astral body is strengthened. Mineralization processes then only occur in us insofar as this consolidates the organs themselves, hence making them stronger. What occurs here is the gentle influence of the eye through sugar. So we could say that by using a decoction of the gentian root, we induce brisk activity in the astral body, while the root's sugar content enables the eye to support this. However, the fact that the eye boosts the effect signifies a danger. If the eye whips things up from below, a polar reaction arises in turn in the head. And we can find that such patients get headaches as a side effect. Yet what I have described does indeed take effect in all these directions. Basically, we have an activating and stimulating of intestinal activity, and we will therefore use such a medicine either on its own or in some combination. Whenever we notice that symptoms and signs are related to loss of appetite, dyspepsia, for instance, and especially various forms of abdominal congestion. We can also see how this gastric and intestinal activity stimulates metabolism in general, inwardly enlivening and activating it, and by this means we can also counteract tendencies to gout and rheumatism. In the gentian root, we will also be drawing on something which combats fever, if only to a mild degree. When intestinal function is undermined, this calls forth a febrile reaction in our upper system. If we strengthen the lower system, therefore, we create a counterweight to our upper pole and have thus administered something that counteracts fever. These are the kinds of exploration we need to pursue to arrive at the specific ways in which the external world relates to our inner processes. It is quite correct to state that external influences stream in on us. Rosenbach is an instance of someone who has done excellent preparatory work in this field. But to speak abstractly of influences fails to grasp that what works upon us from without derives from tangible realities. There is a real relationship between the root nature of plants, the forces active in roots, and what these do when they enter us. Things we otherwise only characterize in the abstract as influences can really be grasped by such insights. And spiritual science is concerned to elaborate really specific aspects, the actual processes at work. With this in mind, let us turn to an extraordinarily instructive plant, Herb Bennett, or Wood Avens, Geum Urbanum, and once again make use of its root as a decoction. It is extremely interesting to investigate Herb Bennett while also remembering that we have just said about the gentian root. Once again, we must, of course, assume that using the root will have a reciprocal effect on head forces. In Herb Bennett root, we have a bitter taste, really extremely tart. The root of Herb Bennett contains essential or volatile oils, and we can, therefore, easily predict that it will affect parts of the organism that are not within nor as close to the intestinal tract as the parts we spoke of in relation to the gentian root. Here there is more of a connection with what needs to happen earlier in the stomach or maybe even the esophagus. The most important constituents to consider in Herb Bennett root are its starches, the amylum content, so that we appeal, in a sense, to forces that assimilate more intensively than is necessary for sugar. In assimilating amylum, readers aside, spelled A-M-Y-L-U-M, amylum, end of readers aside, the power of engagement has to be held back more, so that the sugar can first be drawn out. You can see, therefore, that we really have to trace the processes at work. The Herb Bennett root also contains a tannin, and we must always consider this when studying the medicinal actions of a substance. A tannin means that the substance in question acts upon whatever the tannin encounters in a way that strongly approaches the physical, and we must therefore locate the whole action of Herb Bennett root closer to the eye than to the astral body. Because eye stimulus is enhanced, we have here an activity in the lower part of the human organism as polar effect to stimulation of the head, which the eye brings about there. We are concerned here with what I would call outward digestion, an engagement with substances while they are still in the stomach, before they pass on into the intestinal tract. If I may put it like this, the neurosensory apparatus still present in the intestine, for everything is spread out over the whole human organism, is stimulated, and we therefore find eye activity predominant here. What will be the consequence of this? That, firstly, we have an Herb Bennett root, in Herb Bennett root a strongly antipyretic action. Secondly, though, we will be able to work from more anterior digestive processes on more posterior ones, the actual intestinal processes, by not foisting such a burden on the latter. By this means, we will be able to combat diarrhea in particular, or intestinal mucoenteritis, if we consider that these disorders arise when too much is expected of more interior digestive processes. So you see that these inquiries all lead us to insight into how external forces penetrate what lies in the human interior. Since it is especially important to consider the action of roots, let us take one more root, Iris germanica, garden or bearded iris. Here too we make a decoction. The outward appearance of this iris already tells us that it works strongly on the eye. Its distasteful smell and bitter taste immediately betray the fact that we have here something in which the eye enters into strong physical interplay with the external world. The garden iris root also contains something that greatly stimulates this physical activity, tannic acid. And once again, there is a myelin here, which stimulates eye activity. Finally, the iris root also contains something that takes physical effect wherever it appears, when stimulated to do so. We have resins. All this stimulates the eye to a very brisk activity. And this lively activity of the eye, this impelling power of the eye, can be detected in increased urine activity and a certain purgative effect. These are the external manifestations of eye activity. And the condition we can combat by this means becomes clear simply by asking what the human organism suffers when all this is not in order. We find dropsy and similar disorders. And the iris decoction provides something with which we can try to combat dropsy-type conditions and also dropsy itself. These are the kinds of considerations to be weighed up. Now, if we rise somewhat higher up the plant, we can consider its herbaceous parts. Let us take a characteristic plant such as Marjorana hortensis, or marjoram. But let's be clear, when we ascend to the stalks and foliage, nature itself now accomplishes certain processes which we ourselves first had to undertake with the roots. If we take the herbaceous parts, it is not good to make a decoction, since we need its subtler forces, which we can obtain by making an infusion. These forces pass from the leaves into the infusion. And here again you can detect, through your senses, what is present here. In this infusion of marjoram, you have its distinctive taste, which we could call a, quote, warming taste, close quote. This taste has, at the same time, a somewhat bitter quality. And then you also have something which clearly testifies to an outward-directed action, the aromatic fragrance due to its essential oils. And in addition, there is something needed only to intensify all this to a marked degree, which does not come to physical expression as quickly as the other qualities, but does so only on passing through the stomach and entering intestines. All kinds of salts are contained in the leaves, specifically in marjoram. You can therefore discover, and these things are realities, that this infusion of leaves will act especially on the respiratory activity of the internal organs. It induces a certain respiratory activity in the internal organs. You can see this from the fact that the infusion has a diaphoretic action, causes perspiration, and so, in other words, stimulates inner respiratory activity in the organs. It causes perspiration. And through this reaction, strengthens the internal organs' activity. Administering a marjoram infusion counteracts catarrhal colds. But on the other hand, it can also be used to treat uterine weakness. All these things will come into clearer focus if we now pass to the action of the flower. Let us first observe this action in the plant in nature, where it reveals itself more clearly. For instance, wherever many small flowers unfold in an inflorescence, as in the elder or Sambucus nigra, let us be clear that the forces here shooting into the plant are closely connected with the periphery of the earth and contain cosmic influences and streams. We can see this from the fact that the elderflower also contains essential oils. But, notably, it can be discovered in the sulfur content of the elderflowers. Here we have something from the mineral realm that turns out to be especially effective in stimulating respiration, but from the other direction, that of the respiratory organization itself, as opposed to stimulus of respiration in the digestive organs and in what attaches to them before respiration of the actual breathing organs takes hold of them. The elderflower, when used, this is fairly obvious, as an infusion, especially stimulates the human organism's ether activity. And only on a roundabout route through ether activity does it also stimulate the astral body. In other words, respiration in the upper posterior organs is stimulated particularly, but not so much in the head organs as in those that belong to breathing itself. Naturally, reactions arise everywhere here, and these, of course, show us that in this instance, discharges and perspiration occur. And now it is the respiratory organs which are stimulated. Otherwise, normal respiratory function is given an impetus, and, since this inevitably has an effect on the blood too, this in turn stimulates blood circulation from within. From all this, we can detect that such a medicine can act against catarrh, can combat perspiration retention, and is useful in cases of hoarseness and coughing. Also, since the direct action that previously arose now appears in polar effect, it can be used in rheumatoid conditions. You see, it is important always to anticipate the medicinal powers of an agent by considering its mode of action. Now let us consider that it may be necessary to act on the head organization in particular, what is dependent on the head organization. Digestion is dependent on it as the head organization's polar counterpart. The head organization governs the coarser aspect of digestion, the cause of so many very severe diseases. We must therefore be clear that we can significantly affect the head from these coarser digestive processes, and that whenever we work on the digestion from within, we inevitably also give rise to effects that radiate into the head, and from there unfold their action. We must, of course, keep an overview of all sorts of diverse aspects, and despite first seeking to give an herbal medicine internally, do so in such a way that it affects the head. This can be achieved especially if we use seeds. By their very nature, seeds are very well suited to work directly on coarser digestive processes. By doing so, however, and producing reactions, they also affect the head. But it is very difficult to raise a medicinal action from the digestion so that it enters the head. In the case of seeds, therefore, it is good to resort to a decoction once more, in very concentrated form, as long as the patient can tolerate this. We can study this in particular if we look at the medicinal actions of caraway seeds, of a decoction of these seeds. A decoction contains, firstly, essential oils, and thus exerts strong effects on the eye, and also, again, something with a very strong physical action, wax and also resins, which likewise induce very strong effects in the physical realm. The strength of this action is apparent in the spicy smell. Then, in this decoction, we specifically have galactose. If you connect all this with our observations in the course so far, it has an extremely strengthening effect on eye activity, a substantial effect on the sense and nerve activity hidden in the digestive organs. The effect works particularly on this weak activity of the senses and nerves concealed within the digestive organs and distributed there in a very weakly developed metamorphosis. In relation to our lower organism, a decoction of this kind really works on something that one can call a subconscious metamorphosis of our external sensory perception. You can say that it stimulates our digestive system to perceive the process developing there. And this is why this is such a good medicine for use in animas. Using it as an anima, we invoke a process that inevitably affects the action of the senses and nerves because it administers from without the subtle forces contained in the caraway seeds and thereby awakens a kind of subconscious perception in the organs of digestion. Sluggish tissue fluid is stimulated in particular. So by invoking a process that strengthens the nerves and senses, perception is strongly transposed into our interior. We start to perceive in our digestive organs. And this counteracts and stands, as it were, as an opposite pole to what happens when an inner activity of our organism, which can also now be perceived, though largely in inner perception, begins to manifest in eruptive conditions. By perceiving our own organism very strongly when it develops organic activity of this kind, so that in fact we perceive ourselves, we exert a dampening and thus curative effect on such an activity, which is an outward-directed perception from within, by developing an opposing activity of senses and nerves, resembling a metamorphosis of external perception. This medicine can be beneficial in treating stomach cramps, colic-type conditions, and flatulence. The following further process is really very interesting to observe. Imagine, very vividly, the kind of subconscious activity that develops here. This subconscious activity very closely resembles that of external perception, but has, in a sense, been transposed into our interior. Consider that external perception and reflex activity have a certain mutual connection. When subconscious perceptions arise, they can immediately trigger defensive reactions. So let us consider this interaction between perception and defensive reaction. And now, transpose this onto the inner activity of tissue fluid. You carry out this activity of external perception by floating, as it were, in the air. If I draw this schematically, we can here picture the air around us, permeated by light, and so on. See figure 15. See also plate 6. And here we have external perception unfolding in this direction, the inner response unfolding in this direction. In every sense organ, we do indeed have an interplay of external action and inner reaction. If we want to give an outward abstract picture of this, we should at least not use the one chosen in the modern materialistic view, which states that a centripetal and centrifugal nerve activity is involved here. This interpretation is no cleverer than saying that when one exerts pressure on a rubber ball, it recreates its original shape through a different force than the opposite counter pressure. It is no cleverer to speak of motor nerves than to explain the elasticity of a ball by saying that after pressing on it, one posits some kind of center to its interior, which then pushes out again. What happens, in fact, is merely that the original shape is reestablished. The effect does not require any special nerves, since the whole process of action and counteraction is embedded in astrality and I nature. But now, picture this whole process as occurring by a roundabout route through ether activity in the tissue fluid. See the figure 16 and plate 6. A sensory process does not, of course, occur in the tissue fluid under normal circumstances, but it can be induced by what I just described. then a kind of contracting tendency arises, an approach toward the organism, which I wish to indicate here, in the same way as action in perception. But this is a process that, in a sense, storms against the outward-directed force in the tissue fluid. This asserts itself, and this other counteracts it. Thus we transpose a sensory process, a metamorphosis of the sensory process, into tissue fluid. It is extremely interesting to observe how we here transpose a metamorphosis of the external sensory process into tissue fluid. Now we must see where we can find something like this happening in daily life, so that a kind of metamorphosis of the sensory process arises within us, you could say, as a concentrated sensory process in tissue fluid. This happens when milk forms and is secreted during female lactation. Here we have a metamorphosis of external sensory processes transposed inward and concentrated as breast milk. Now let us assume that when needed, this process of lactation does not adequately occur. Then we have very good reason to bring about this concentrated and inward transposed sensory process. And in a decoction of caraway seed, we have what invokes such a process and promotes lactation. I have cited these examples to show how we can regard the whole working and activity of this human organism and its interrelationship with what exists in the surrounding world. Consider what I have presented to you here. Consider it in precise detail. In the decoction of the caraway seed, there is resin and wax, and therefore something whose consistency invokes especially strong physical effects. Thus the resin, the wax, is extraordinarily similar to my outer sensory impressions, but just inwardly concentrated. And this seed, again, contains essential oil and galactose, which stimulates the reactivity of the eye. Here you have everything present together that also exists in the sensory process, the external stimulus, the inner reaction, penetrating as far as the eye, again, capital I, as it's been all through this. Now, you metamorphose this sensory process by virtue of the fact that instead of a sensory perception, you transpose this reciprocal effect inward, into the system of forces of the tissue fluid. Then you have something that invokes an inner sensory process in you, which is what the process of lactation is. You will see how we can come to understand the whole organism by this means. These are the inquiries we need to engage in if we wish to gain understanding of the inner action of external substances. If we take the example of mineral or metal medicines, we will easily be able to gain insight to something we already learned in relation to the action of a herbal medicine. But we will also be able to see here that something has happened to the mineral, whereby mineral qualities have been carried through into the plant process. What occurs in mineralization and vegetabilization involves a reconfiguring of mineral forces. Something in the process of healing, therefore, depends on the reconfiguration of mineral forces. Let us assume that we establish a clinic, surround it with fields, and fertilize these fields with various mineral substances. We now have an active soil and are aware of what it contains, and cultivate diverse plants there for their roots, leaves, fruit, and so forth. Thus we control the whole process, which involves the plant transforming minerals into medicines. We can intensify this by growing plants such as those we were just describing, which can indeed be treated in this way. That's what we are trying to do at our institute in Stuttgart. That's how it has to be done. But then we can go still further. The medicine we have obtained in this way, through the plant, can in turn be used as a kind of fertilizer, which will intensify its action. We will obtain something which renders normal physical trituration substantially more effective. In other words, transforms it into something extremely active. Readers aside, trituration, I'm hoping I'm spelling that right or pronouncing that right, it's T-R-I-T-U-R-A-T-I-O-N, trituration or trituration, end of readers aside. Let me read that again. We will obtain something which renders normal physical trituration substantially more effective, in other words, transforms it into something extremely active, by asking nature itself, the forces active in nature, to prepare it for us. We must also then, of course, be clear about the following. For instance, we can ask how a mineral or metal preparation is to be effective, how it should act. The salts, which by the way are also mineral medicines, engender more of an interior effect. The most peripheral activities, however, are influenced precisely by mineral or metal substances, which one can say are the most inherently consistent. Here we will have to weigh up the best course of action, but always, as I said, drawing on the foundation of spiritual scientific insights. For otherwise one's thoughts fragment and shoot off down all sorts of mistaken paths. Spiritual scientific ideas give the proper direction to such thinking. For instance, we can have a particular metal and know that the interior of the human organism can only engage with it very weakly. So here the activity of the eye needs greatly stimulating, for the eye is what reaches down, as it were, into the inner nature of substance, arranges this inner nature according to its purposes, and then invokes eye activity within the organism. Since the eye can be strengthened in this activity by the astral body, if we use metals, use minerals, we must always ensure that we also stimulate eye activity or astral activity, which then works back upon the eye, or the interaction between astral activity and eye activity. We can, for example, do this as follows. We prepare a metal ointment and apply it. We apply it, let us say, to treat a skin rash. In doing so, we activate eye activity peripherally. This eye activity is likewise stimulated through the person's inner reaction. Within him, initially, intensified nerve and sense activity develops in a particular organ, and from there intensified respiratory activity by passing over into the astral realm. And then we obtain an action emanating from within of forces that counteract the skin rash. In this way, we call upon the whole body to combat the skin rash. We can, of course, generally study the effects of different metals and minerals. In lead, for instance, you have something that exerts an extremely powerful effect on the activity of nerves and senses, and then, in turn, on associated internal respiration, but also on the internal respiratory activity which occurs, for instance, in the outer peripheral organs. So, if we use lead when we need to induce an effect, as has just been described, we can find it to be very beneficial, used as ointment or also given by mouth. Administered internally, we must of course be clear that we are calling forth a reaction in the upper organism by stimulating the activity of the digestive organs. If we use carefully prepared ointments on the upper organism, we are working directly on this upper system itself. And if a patient has some kind of debility in the head, only poorly developed activity of the nerves and senses, and likewise deficient respiration, such lead treatments can achieve a great deal, as long as we stop short of a toxic dose. In all such things, construed from what we have learned in recent days and also from our previous course, the following is important to remember. A very important contrast exists here. Metals that tend more toward silver are in a sense polar to all those which tend toward lead. In relation to these things, of course, our mineral classification systems are really very inadequate indeed. In a system of mineral classification more in accord with nature, such affinities and relationships between metals would have to be considered. And then we would see that lead compounds and lead itself are at one end of the scale, while silver is at the other, and aurum, gold, for instance, in the middle. The other metals would all be ranged somewhere along this scale. Silver and lead are polar opposite to each other, because silver acts directly on the limbs and metabolism, doing so in a very peripheral way, acting to a large degree on the outward-oriented aspect of the organism of limbs and metabolism. Lead, by contrast, works on the outward-oriented aspect of the head organism. In other words, silver stimulates nerve and sense activity in the system of metabolism and limbs. From there, promoting an activity that permeates the whole body and stimulates respiration in all I referred to yesterday as a metamorphosis of the central heart organ. By contrast, all that issues from lead acts on the nerve and sense activity of the head and on the activity of breathing stimulated from there. Thus, it has a stimulating effect on all that is embodied in the other metamorphosis, the configuration of the head, of the lungs, of the liver, and therefore those organs which in a sense enclose and encompass our other organization in the same way that the lungs encompass the heart. This organization really reveals the archetypal form of what we are in our entirety as circulatory organism. We have the lungs that enclose the heart, so that the breathing system in a sense encompasses and embraces the circulatory system. But we likewise have a broader kind of respiration if we consider the human being in the configuration of brain, lungs, and liver. In other words, the whole upper posterior system. And this respiration encompasses all blood vessels together with the heart. The upper posterior system in this way encloses and encompasses the digestive organization and also the sexual organization. The organization is such that the upper posterior system in us really encloses the lower anterior part of us. These two aspects interpenetrate, so that the upper posterior parts are superimposed upon the lower and anterior parts. And this mutuality chiefly manifests in the reciprocal relation between heart and lungs. If we carefully observe this and study the rhythmic aspect within this interaction, and then also the activity of nerves and senses above and behind, which naturally has its other pole in the forward and lower system, and if we consider the processes at work in the metabolism and limbs in the anterior and lower parts, and in turn in their other elaboration in the upper and posterior parts, then the whole human being stands before us. And then, accordingly, we can understand the other processes at work in us. From this point of departure, we will proceed tomorrow to a specific discussion of our own medicines, during which some questions that have been raised will find their natural answers. The end of Lecture 7.